Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with distinguished scientist, educator, author, artist, leader, activist, Dr. Nyativa Kathuri, who shares her insights into computing, education, the global condition, the future of technology, career, and life lessons. Nyativa, you bring a substantive history of significant and considerable international contribution to research, computing science, education, art, and leadership to this interview. We are very fortunate to have you come in to do this interview with us, and thank you.
Thank you, Stephen, for having me. It's my pleasure.
You know, Nyativa, I've looked at your background, and it's just amazing. So can you profile your remarkable history?
Sure. Well, I was born in Israel, and after Israel was born, and to parents who were among the pioneers, my father actually was born in Israel, third generation, so I'm a fourth generation Israeli. My mother came from Greece at a young age. So I was raised in the spirits of a new country, pioneering. My father also was an artist, and he fought with the British in the Jewish Brigade in Europe, and learned some art there in Holland after the war. So I lived in a family that was artistic, which gave me a little artistic side to me, which you may have seen on my website. At age 12, my father left the family for 2 years in Paris ahead of us. And my mom and my brother and I, we moved to live in a kibbutz from Tel Aviv, from the big city. So that was a big change in my life. From 12 to 14, we lived in a kibbutz, and which actually formed a lot of my personality, I think. At age 14, we joined my father in Paris, and that was another big move from the tiny little kibbutz to the big city and totally new lifestyle. New language. I did not know a word. And I lived there for 5 years. I did a high school there in one of the best high schools in Paris. And at age 18, 19, I moved back to Israel to do my military service. And my family joined me right after. The military service was a great opportunity for me to flourish, to bloom. I became first. I was a math and physics teacher, which showed me that I could teach. It was amazing, a revelation for me. And soon after, I did a military officer school, and I became a second lieutenant of 300 military teachers, which gave me another experience. After the 2 years military service, I went to the university, Tel Aviv University, to study math and French, double major. 2 years later, I did not finish my bachelor there because I married an American tourist, and I moved to America, to Chicago, actually, where I'm still here. So I pursued my studies here at the University of Illinois, got all my 3 degrees there. And in between, I worked in industry, and I decided to go into computer science from the math. I had a family, 3 girls, and on. Ask me more.
No, it's interesting. You indicated that the school that you went to, this high school you went to, was pretty special. Can you tell me why it was special?
You're talking about the school in Paris?
Yes, that's right.
Because my French was not so great, the local high school did not know to take me. And so my parents were obliged to put me in a private school. At first, I was in a semi-private school, and the following year, I went to a École Alsacienne, which was considered then and even now one of the best schools in Paris. Children of ministers, of famous actors went there. That school really recognized the value of foreign people, and I was approached with a big respect, and I was well accepted and welcome, and that made a big difference. And I still keep touch with my friends. I go to Paris almost every year, and I kept a lot of my high school friends there. So it has been a very good experience.
You know, what career and personal lessons do you wish to pass on from your journey of many successes?
Okay, I can tell you, it took me almost 20 years to get my doctorate. because I, unlike some others, I did not finish school right away. I raised my children. So one thing I learned is perseverance. I saw mostly the obstacles. I was a very good student. But somehow the doctorate level seemed like so far-fetched, and I made it even higher than it was. So I think the perseverance, the consistency is the one big lesson I can push for, the patience. Also, what I see from my teaching and other experiences in life is love, a smile, tend a hand, be a good friend, balancing career and family are very, very important things. So that's what I would like to pass on.
You know, I was looking at the many roles that you've had, and it's so rich in terms of experience. So can you sort of pinpoint one defining lesson from each of your many roles?
Okay, one important role that I received, I was lucky to have been accepted to become a Fulbright Scholar in Benin, West Africa. I think I always had in mind to go to Africa, and one lesson my father gave me was to volunteer, to always be first, to initiate, to risk, to take risk. And, people were amazed that I chose to go to Benin after my last kid left the house. So I was already a mature woman, and I was here alone with my husband, and I decided to take such a big step. But I felt like I was I served the country first, because I was really an ambassador of the U.S. to Africa, to Benin. I was a model there for women, because there were very few women in universities, in education, women. We can talk about women later on again, but I thought I served as a role model. Also, being in a foreign land and country so many other times besides Benin, West Africa, which was so much different than the Western countries I've lived, taught me to listen to others, because they have a story to tell, and their stories is amazing. It's wonderful. I became a journalist, really, my own journalist, and you can see it on my website. I wrote a journal for my whole year in Benin, even about how to raise a chicken, you know, just observing the birds in my backyard. So integrating into a new culture, that was one big lesson from the life in West Africa. CPSR, Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility, that's another big role I had. And I'm very proud of my work there. I was appointed regional director for the Midwest, and I served for 6 years with the Computer Professional for Social Responsibilities. We started as a national board, and we had only maybe 1,400 members, and I think it still remains a very small number, because those are unique people, the members of Computer Professional for Social Responsibilities. They're so unlike other professionals, because we have the social responsibility, the ethics in mind, and that's one thing that I push till today. But there I served also as a membership vice president, as I served in many other roles in the PTA, in my temple board, and any other board I ever served on. I always gravitated to membership, because I've been new to so many other places. I know how hard it is to be a new person on the block, and I always reach to new people and make them feel good. So in CPSR, I took a lot of initiatives, and that's another lesson I'd like to call on people, is take initiatives. No one told me what to do. I became a regional director, and that's it. Not other word was uttered to tell me what to do and what not to do. They did give me the bylaws, but, you know, the bylaws don't say much. So I actually created that role. I contacted all the people in my region from all the states around the Midwest. And because listservs were new at the time, I served, I think, from 96 to 2002. So I put them all on a listserv, and I've done like different little chapters, one in Wisconsin, one in Illinois, one in Michigan, one in Indiana, one in Ohio, and we were all communicating on those listservs. And that was amazing. I mean, I think it was the first time ever done. Now you see that very common nowadays with the social networking, but then it was pretty new. So people felt more involved, and a lot of things happened. I started working groups by topics. So we had an ethics working group, a women gender working group, computer cyber law working group, and a whole other bunch of them. And they're still in existence, I believe. Many of them are working. So that's one lesson is in CPSI is to trust yourself, to take initiative, and do well. I also started international chapters because I've known people in all over the world. I decided why not get them into CPSR and create chapters in their country. We never had international chapters before, and I think our first international chapter was actually Africa. So that was a huge success that Africans were able to organize and create a chapter with my support. Later on, we added Spain and other countries around the world. I'm not involved that much anymore with CPSR. I'm just a regular member, a life member. So I'm not quite sure where it is, but I think at the time, for the 6 years I was there, it was working really well. Okay, women. I'm right now a guest editor of Women in IT on the Computer Society of India Communications newsletter. Also, I've been a reviewer for the Journal of Women and Minorities in Science and Engineering and other journals. So this is women is an important part of my life to encourage women into technology and the fields around it. As you may know, we were always a minority in computer science and MIS. For a while, there was a lot of activism done around it, and the numbers were increased. But in the last 10 years, the numbers are dropping. I think right now we are around 10%. In academia, you find maybe 10% of women, which is very little, and I see my students being very discouraged. So in all my endeavors, I try to be a role model, show that women now more than ever before can do more in the area of technology because the field has increased. It's not just for techies, just for geeks. It is for many, many other ways. And women are multitaskers, so they can really excel in that field. I've been active in my village of Skokie. I was a cable commissioner, and we've done much there too. I will not enumerate on that. And recently, I've become a member of the ACM Professional Development Committee, and I'm looking forward to doing more there. I haven't done enough, I guess. I'm pretty new. Anything else, Stephen?
Well, you know, those are some great roles that you've had in your life, and, you know, there are many sort of lessons that you've passed on, and, you know, there's a remarkable kind of history of contribution. So it sounds like you would recommend that people do contribute to different societies and different groups and to volunteer their expertise.
Yeah, that's so important. People are so passive, you know, many people just wait to be called, and I think... And I know I keep on hearing my father in the back of my head, take initiative, volunteer. And I think if I didn't have that voice in me, I may just sit back and wait. And I think it's really important that we help, we tend a hand to those who are in need and just take initiative. Even if they are not in need, just take initiative, do new things, do things that you think should be done. Be the first, you know, don't think that because no one else went there, it's not the right thing. I know people like to be like sheep, you know, and you can see it even walking in the street, you know, people go where everybody else goes, and even though there's another route to go. It is important to just do what you think is right, trust yourself, and take chances. They say success is for those who take chances, so of course there's a chance of failing, but, you know, that's part of life. And exactly in my profession, you know, in computer science, as you know, when you write a program or you design a system, there are always failures. You always have to test, and errors are a lot all over the place. So it's good to get used to being at fault, to have errors, and you can fix them. And And that's really the route to take. I know a lot of companies send software into the market, and with a lot of bugs, it's just accepted behavior that you want to be there on time. You should. There are bugs in there, and then we always have to live with the plugs and repairs and whatever. And I think we should spend more time on trying to fix those. Here, I went on a tangent. Sorry. Go ahead, Stephen. Ask me more.
You know, what were some key disruptive forces driving change in your life, and how can we learn from your experience?
One disruptive force is all my moving about. And I think one thing that served me living in France, the fact that I was not that good in French at first, I went into mathematics. I was good in all areas. And I think being a woman, I probably would be attracted to other areas like sociology, behavioral sciences, philosophy. But living in a foreign country forced me to go into mathematics, because from mathematics, I was told I can go anywhere. So that's what I did. And it served me in the long run because, you know, there were not that many people in math and later on in computer science. So it gave me an opportunity to, you know, an easier way to get a job, to excel, and from there on to move to other areas. Being a computer science professor was not my dream, maybe, but I decided to go into areas that I like. That's why I designed courses like women in computing, like computer ethics, like authoring systems, just to diversify. So the changes in my life, I think, the disruptive forces, like moving around, forced me into the computer science, into the mathematics, and that helped. Children, of course, it's a wonderful disruptive force, and I would never give up on that. I mean, for me, my children were the happiest moment of my life. I think any woman would testify to that. With all the hardships, it's like the best gift that we can give to the world is giving birth to a child. And but it is disruptive. It was very hard to work and get my doctorate while I was raising my children and continue in school and excel. But they keep you there, keep you thinking of what's important. And I think maybe that's one thing that one reason where I did not go beyond my university, beyond Chicago. I had other chances of going elsewhere, but I waited, like with Benin, for example. I waited till the last kid left the house. I could have gone to a better university and et cetera, but so sometimes the disruptive things keep you at home and give you joy and happiness, and still you go around it and you succeed in what you do.
What are your research interests?
Okay, so a couple of them I already mentioned, like women in computing is one thing that I was interested in thanks to CPSR, because that's where I first heard about it. I had no idea that, you know, we were different. I noticed that we were small numbers, but it never affected me until I heard some lectures about it, and it opened my eyes, and I started teaching differently. Ethics, same way. I was attracted to computer professional for social responsibility because of their social responsibility. And then I went into and did some research in ethics, and I presented many papers in the ethics area, privacy especially. And then in 2003, I received also a sabbatical leave to work on a security book. And that was like in the beginning when people started being interested in computer security. So that was very interesting to me at the time. I'm still teaching a couple courses in it, cryptography and security. And computer in education, that's my doctorate actually was in the teaching of mathematics to teachers of mathematics. So I'm very interested in the education and how to teach and how to make sure that students are interested in what you teach. So, and technology is a fantastic new tool, still at its infancy, we can say, and there's a lot of research that can be done there. So this is the future still for me.
You know, you've developed like 40 major papers and presentations for journals, and you've done many conferences and so on. What I'd like to do is now kind of drill down. Can you distill some important insights from these many articles and presentations and share them?
Well, I can talk first about my first research that I've done. It was a core grant, we call it, at Northeastern Illinois University, where I teach now. And I did it with another professor, and it was on computers. Is it a revolution? And this was in the early 80s. Very few people had personal computers, and hardly anybody used it at our university at the time. I think I was the only person on campus with email, and I remember, I can't even remember exactly what questions I did in my research, but I interviewed a lot of people and asking them, do you think a computer is a revolution? It's going to revolutionize us. And amazingly, a lot of people didn't think so. They, you know, because they were not involved in it, and a lot of people even refused to use it, even though it was available to them. I know my department only started using email recently. So what was amazing in that research is that my partner was in sociology, and I never did any research in sociology. And we looked at the data we got, and she pointed out, you know, you can do it a little differently. Just look at the results you have and see how men and women respond differently. And that was actually before even I was interested in women in computing, that all of a sudden I noticed, yes, you can look at data and break it down into different ways. If you break it down between the results between men and women, you find differences. So that was my first discovery just through doing research, that men and women had different, totally different answers to my questionnaire. I don't even remember what the answers were. I didn't go over it again, but I can find out. But that was a significant difference between them. And that was thanks to my partner in sociology. So even people in science can do research in that kind of borders of sociology. And from there on, I continued in that manner, and I learned a lot. So another area that I researched was computers and privacy. The email is not private. And as I said before, computer in education. Like even I remember one paper I wrote was in operating systems. I taught operating systems to my students, and I realized that it can be a boring topic. And I found a way of teaching it using a play, role play. And I divided the class into like different programs getting into, and the classroom was like the internal memory of the computer. So we had queues, and we had a CPU, the processor, and we had the operating system. Each person took a role, and we pretended like people are standing in line in queue to get into like a restaurant. So the operating system was like the host, the hostess, sitting down people at tables and serving them, taking turns between tables. And the CPU is there in the kitchen, preparing the food. So I tell you, it made the class more interesting. And I remember writing a paper about it, and that was very nicely accepted because it was different.
Yeah, that'd be great. And I think that's really quite interesting. Pretty innovative, I think, in terms of...
It was very innovative, and I should have maybe continued in that route, but, you know, we have so many courses to teach, and that was one particular course that I enjoyed playing around with it, and it gave me a great result at the time. But I haven't taught it now in a good long time, at least 10 years.
So I guess that's a natural segue then into this sort of question, and that is, which courses do you enjoy the most teaching and why?
So as I mentioned before, computer science was not really for me, I think. When I went to school, when I was an undergrad, I think we had the mainframe computer and in Tel Aviv, and I took Fortran. I had to write a computer program in Fortran, and we did it on punch cards at the time. But I had a chance of choosing between going into pure math or going into computer science, and I remember I didn't want computer science at all. It was not attractive to me. But somehow, when I was here in America, I had to get a job, and I decided to quit going to school for a while. I married my second husband, who did not have a great viewpoint on PhD at the time. He pushed me into going into industry. So I know I'm going a little on a tangent, but I learned that that I had to combine the many loves that I had with the job that I had. It was easy to go into computer science because the jobs were available. And later on, I got the job that I wanted, I was dreaming about, to become a professor. So I got it because I was in computer science. Not because I loved computer science, but that's what I got. Because, you know, sometimes you have to find a balance, as I said, between the skills that you have and that make money and the love that you have. So what I did, I created interdisciplinary courses. And I really believe in interdisciplinary studies. And, you know, over the years, it happened to be the truth. Right now at Northeastern, we are developing a whole program of interdisciplinary studies. And I think all over the country, it's like the new fashion. Many universities are adopting interdisciplinary programs. So I combined things that I liked, like women in computing, like computer ethics, like computer-aided instruction, you know, my love of education, which later on became authoring methodologies, authoring methods in computing. So we writing author courseware using computers. Web design, I teach a lot of web design, which is a combination of, you know, aesthetics, artistry, any kind of content area that you like into the web. So all this, anything that is interdisciplinary, like, you know, art also combined with computers is what I like and what I love, and I combined it with what I know how to do using computers. So those are my favorite courses. Of course, I teach them straightforward, like operating systems or programming, but the interdisciplinary courses are my love, and I enjoy teaching them.
I guess the, you know, doing this kind of teaching of interdisciplinary courses is going to help to increase the enrollments in IT as well, or in computing.
The enrollment of women, especially. I teach now a course of women in computing now, and as my students are discovering, is that, you know, men do focus more into one area only, and they excel in what they do. Women, on the other hand, you know, maybe from the old evolution time as gatherers, food gatherers, they're interested in many, many different things. They like, some of them like computing, but they have other loves, other likes, so they don't want to stick, just like I am, you know, they don't like to stick only in one thing. So that's a great thing, that we can have interdisciplinary studies, and that will attract more women, I hope. Of course, to attract more women, we need also to make the department more appealing. Right now, many computer science departments are not very attractive to women. The atmosphere is not compelling for women to join, and there are very few women there. So, of course, we need a critical mass to attract more women, and need to change maybe the curriculum a bit and train the teachers. Many things have to be changed, but I think the interdisciplinary side of it is very attractive. And I think now they have computers and humanities, and so that's a very good sign, and I think I trust that will be very attractive to women in the future.
So, you know, this is related to this whole idea of education. There's all of this technology available. The internet is so pervasive today.
Right.
So what are your thoughts on online and hybrid learning?
Yeah, just last semester and this semester are my first semester teaching hybrid classes. First of all, it's very hard on the teacher because I'm just designing them at the same time as I'm teaching them, and there's so much work. But I trust that in the long run, when my courses are going to be a little more affirmed, you know, more, you know, prepared, I think that both kinds of students will maybe be attracted to it. For our university, we are a commuter school, so most students drive from very far away, take trains. And for them, I think hybrid classes or online classes may be very appealing. I think throughout the country, I mean, rural areas have hard times, you know, reaching a computer, especially in universities. So online classes can be very attractive in that respect, especially for the handicapped and other people who have other responsibilities like jobs, children. So that's the outside appeal. But while you're taking the course, I think there's other advantages to have online courses and, of course, disadvantages. I can talk a little bit more about the advantages. Is if you are a shy person, no one knows it. No one knows, you know, what you look like. But especially being shy, waiting for people to call on you, and not all teachers call on all the students. That's why, you know, many times, you know, you go to a class and you see the same people talk. But online, everybody gets equal chance. And usually a good teacher will ask all the students to participate so many times a week. so people feel compelled to participate. They don't just have to show up in class. They actually have participation. Doesn't mean just show the warm body there, but to actually write something, or, you know, if it's done on in an online kind of a community server. So this is a one big thing. Another advantage is that maybe the self-pace. And if you're sitting in a class, you have to go with the stream. You have to go with the flow. And usually teachers aim toward the average student. So the fast students are slowed down and maybe bored in a classroom. And the slower students are lost because it's too fast for them. And being online or in a hybrid class, you can go at your pace. So you can go fast and do other things, or you can go spend all your time there and catch up with the class. So those are great advantages. The one big disadvantage for me is I like the social contact. I like to see my students face-to-face. So in a way, a hybrid is a nice combination between the two. And that's what I'm doing now. I see my students half the time. So, and the other half time they have to write. We use Blackboard as technology, which is not the best, but that's what we have. And so far, it's asynchronous, meaning that they can participate in the middle of the night anytime they want. We don't use synchronous yet, which is like a chat room, because our technology is not that good yet. Or if it is, there is something there. You cannot have a whole class participate at the same time. It may be good for small groups, which is a good thing too. And that's one thing, I always divide my classes into small teams. I think many students like to work in small teams. They all get a more of a chance to participate, to express themselves, and people have a chance to learn to listen to others. So all of this is, you can see that both sides of a hybrid and versus online or versus on the ground or whatever they call it, in-class experiences. So I'm a great believer of online possibility, but not solely. So I think the regular conventional classes should remain, or at least turn into hybrids, but keep some touch there. You know, for many students just do not like it. Many people want to have the teachers there at hand. And I know some students have told me, I don't like not see you. And I understand that. But I noticed in the last few years, I have less and less people come to my office because I have email, because they can call me on the phone or they talk to me on email and ask questions. So I think it's working. It's working for many, many people. The world is changing. I think our students live online. They live more and more virtual lives. So the universities have to change with them. They don't want to come. A lot of them don't want to come. Some do. So we should accommodate both audiences, the ones who want to be there and the ones who don't, who have other lives. And, of course, it is a distraction, I believe, you know, having such a interesting life. I was thinking in terms of last night, I was preparing for this interview today. I was thinking about how my life is different now than it was when I was a child. As a child, I remember I was making lists and lists of all the things I could do when I'm bored. Now, Stephen, have you ever been bored lately? I don't think any of us is ever bored again. There's so much there. We didn't have television as a child. I didn't have even a telephone until I was 19, and we had to share it with our neighbors. TV, I only had when we arrived to France. We bought a TV. We didn't have it in Israel at those days. So a lot of things we didn't have. So communication nowadays is happening, you know, online a lot. We all attached to some kind of, you know, mobile or not so mobile instrument. And I hope we're not totally giving up on the person-to-person touch. But being virtual does afford us friendships and communications with people all over the world. And that's the nice thing. I can be friends with Africans and Asians and Europeans and Americans, and not just the people on my street. I remember as a kid, all I had is the kids on my street, and I didn't always like them. So this is a great advantage. Same thing with education.
Right.
So let's keep a hybrid there, you know, and so people can come and see me in person, see each other in person, sit around a table at the cafeteria and talk, touch hands, real hands, or communicate online, whichever is good for them.
You know, Nativa, earlier you talked about, you know, you're just your passion for you know, working with women, but also sort of increasing the participation of women in computing. But you did a presentation on this, women in computing. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I do every year. I do a presentation on women in computing at my school. You know, March is the Women History Month. Today, actually, March 8th is International Day for Women, and a lot is happening all over the world, I think, around that. So especially I talk about women in computing, not just women in general, and I believe that women can do whatever they want, you know. If they like technology, they should go into technology. You know, when you know how there's a difference between nature and nurture. It's true that boys, little boys, are raised differently than little girls. You know, little girls are maybe more protected, not given as much chance to explore. So nurture may have differentiated that, but also nature. Boys are more techies, more geeky, like to break into clocks and take them apart, and girls do not care so much about that. Also, girls get into puberty earlier on, and they have other interests that take them away from, you know, from what the boys are interested in. So we are different than the boys and the men, but we may like the same thing. And a lot of us like the technology part of it. As I mentioned before, we also are interested in many other things. Women like to attach the technology to reality, real world. We like to do things that can help other people. So women like to care, and that's why there are so many teachers and nurses and librarians that are women. So why not combine them with the technology if we love the technology? So women should be able to go there. Also, you can look at it from the diversity point of view and from a democracy point of view. Having mostly men in the computer area creates tools and programs and all the things that we create here that are designed mostly by men and therefore for men. You know, just look at the gaming industry. A lot of the games are played by both boys and girls, men and women, though mostly men and boys. You don't see that many women in it, though I think now women are changing and you can see a little more women playing. But I think if women become designers, not just users, the world can change. The games can change, or anything that we design into cars, into houses, into whatever is being designed, not just by men, also by women, the world will look better to all of us. And as you know, in business, in industry, or whatever, when you create a product, when you work on a project, if only one kind of person work on it, you get a product that is, you know, tilted, not well balanced. I think a team that works on a project should be diversified, you know, many races, both genders, because each one can contribute other aspects. So this is a very important, the diversity of it, and it's more democratic to have women there. We are, after all, we are more than 50% of the population. Only using a small portion of us is just not very democratic and not good for the business world also and for any kind of area. So let the women be involved, and women do not hesitate and join the group and change the world and help make the Department of Computer Science a little more attractive to us women.
You know, you talked about your time in Africa. Do you have some stories to share?
Oh, do I have stories? I can talk and talk and talk about it. I invite you to go to my website, you know, at nativa.net, and look for my Benin journal I have a few PowerPoint presentations there on many different aspects. The stories, I can tell you just the way I live, how I arrived there in the middle of the night. I was taken by the professor who met me at the airport, and we were driving through, you know, along a long road from Cotonou to Porto Novo, and alongside the road there were women mostly and some men selling food on a small cookware. It was amazing, very, very different than what we are used to here. I went to sleep with chanting around me. There was some kind of a voodoo feast, and only men were participating. Women are not allowed at that. and the chanting was beautiful, and I went to sleep with it. And of course, at 4 o'clock in the morning, the rooster wakes me up, and that's every morning. I had a wake up call at 4 a.m, and then by 5, I had the Muslim imam wake me up again if I fell back to sleep, or with a call to the, you know, to their practitioners. I mean, there are 30% of Beninese are Muslim. So my whole experience, like going to sleep at night with chanting and waking up with the roosters and then with the imam call for prayer, was a very interesting thing. There's something in Benin called Gri-Gri. That's a voodoo belief. It's kind of a spell put on something. And I remember somebody was telling me the story of when Kenya and Nigeria were playing football together, it rained. And in Nigeria, I believe that similar practice of voodoo like Benin, which is just next door, believe that the rain is a bad omen. They stop playing because if the rain, they just stop playing, and Kenya won the game without any opposition. So that's one example that I heard about. But from my own experience, I went with some friends there. Almost every Sunday night, there was a restaurant where there was dancing on Sunday night. So we would eat or drink, and we would go dancing. And I noticed that I always liked to go dancing with a bunch of them, but I noticed that always one person had to stay at the table. And I asked, why can't we all dance? Why do you have to stay at the table? And finally, they explained to me they were afraid that if they leave the table unattended, somebody will put maybe poison in their drinks. They really were very scared of that. So all throughout my stay there, people were very, even though you think they were very confident and very forwarding, very nice people, but on the other hand, they were very untrusting. They were afraid that somebody would do gri-gri or something. They would put poison in their drinks or do something on their way just to cause them harm. And that's a not very nice story, but that's something that I had to live with. 50% of all Beninese believe still in voodoo, though, and because 20% are Christian, 30% are Muslims. But really, even if they're Muslims or Christians, they still believe in voodoo. I would say altogether, 95% of all Beninese are voodoo practitioners too, and believers, which is a way of life beside being a religion. There were lots of other stories, and I'm trying to remember what else I can tell you. Like being fat, for example. I remember I broke my foot there in the middle of the year, and I could not do as much exercise as I used to. I had to stop doing tennis. And so I started gaining a little weight, and all of a sudden I started getting complimented on how good I look because I gained weight. And it's true, the women in Benin are from all sizes, but the more rounded one are always believed to be more beautiful. So that's something I learned, that, you know, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. And in Benin, the fatter you are, the more beautiful you are. So that was kind of a nice thing to have, you know, here in this country. So I only get complimented when I lose weight, not when I gain weight. So that was another thing. Another story is about water. Of course, I had to boil my water. In Porto Novo, which is the capital where I live, actually the water was pretty good. And after a while, I started drinking it directly from the faucet. But in Cotonou, which is the big city where most people live, there you cannot drink, even not boiled water. You have to buy it in bottles. It's very unsanitary. At home, we would keep in my bathroom, I kept a reservoir of water because once in a while we would have a shortage of electricity, and I would have to use my reservoir to drink and to wash. So I remember I would be always scared. Usually the electricity would stop for about 3 days. So for 3 days I didn't have hot water or anything like that. But I remember to wash every morning, I would take a cup of water. I would make sure that I would not use more than a cup and wash my whole body with one cup of water. And amazingly, when I was telling this to people, no one believed me that you can, but you can wash really with one cup. You can do a whole body wash and stay very clean. So that was one good lesson, that how wasteful we are in this country, and we can really be more careful.
Well, I think all of these stories are fascinating, and I would invite the audience to have a look and to delve in and mine all of that richness that's in your website. It's just amazing.
I know that once in a while when something is in the news, like right now in Togo there's something in the news, or I think a few years ago when there was this coup there in Togo, which is another country to the west of Benin. And since I visited there too, I visited in Togo, in Burkina Faso, in Ghana. So every once in a while, people find my pictures on my website and they ask me, can I use it? So I remember some journals, some newspapers asking if they can use my pictures from Togo. It was cheaper than send somebody there to Togo to take pictures. So that's another anecdote. And so my pictures are probably all over the world, you know. And actually one person even wrote a book in French, L'homme de bois, which is a man of wood, which is a tree man, and he found a picture of a tree that I took from a magic forest, beautiful tree that looked like a man, and he put it on his front page. So it even went into a second edition. And one day I found in my door, he lives in Canada. I never met the author, but one day he came and gave me a present, and he did for my pictures that I took, somebody did for him a nice vitrage, how do you call it, picture made of glass of it, and it's now sitting on my window, and it's really pretty. So yes, so if you find something interesting from my pictures or my experiences from a year in Benin, go ahead. I'm inviting you to use it. Just give me credit for what you take.
Well, that's a very kind offer. You know, again, looking at all your roles now, moving on, what are your biggest challenges?
Challenges. Well, when you're a role model in a way, when you instead in front of a class, you have to always be prepared. And so it is a challenge, and I have to keep up with my students. Nowadays, they know more things than I know. You know, they are, you know, it's amazing how they go on the internet, they learn things so fast. So I learned, you know, to let them be. Actually, you know, I believe in the motto that, you know, when you hear, you forget. When you see, you learn. When you do, you actually finally know it. And so I let them be, you know, I let my students do and teach each other and teach me. So I'm just there mostly as a facilitator. So one challenge is actually to keep up and give my students recognition of what they do and can do. But it is hard to keep up with them, that's for sure, because they are faster than me now. I'm getting slow with time. Challenges. You know, I'm looking forward to actually be retired in a year and a half, and I know this is going to be a big challenge to find, because I believe that I have another half life ahead of me, and I'm looking forward to doing new things. And it is a big challenge to find something very motivating, because teaching was a wonderful, wonderful life, very satisfying. So I know that I'll be looking for more things, like writing some more books, and this time maybe a novel, writing something about my life in Benin, and doing more painting. As I mentioned before, I'm coming from an artistic family, and I've become an artist myself. And so it will be a challenge, I think, to go into a different direction and do something totally different. So I don't know. We'll see how it goes. And a success, what is success is what makes you happy, I think, what makes you, you know, satisfied, you know, that you've done the most you can do. And it doesn't have to be something that other people recognize. And it's a challenge sometimes. People think that success is usually defined by others. And we need to tell ourselves that what's good for us and not to always listen to others.
That's a great lesson about defining success in terms of your sort of context and not necessarily relying on external references.
It's very hard, I tell you. It's very hard. I know that. But more and more, you know, over the years, I noticed that I let go. I used to be more of a leader, I think, than I am now. Always taking, like you said, taking initiative, always doing things. And more I'm putting people at leadership positions. I'm letting them lead. And I think I feel like rewarded by seeing my own students succeed, other friends, other colleagues succeed by me letting them have a leading role. I think it's very satisfying to see other people do that because everybody can. And some people need a little push. And for me to step back is a challenge for me also, you know, because usually I always want to jump in. So sometimes it's just nice just to step back, let the young do, and it's their turn. And of course, not to forget me too. I mean, still do what I like, but, and again, to define my own success in my own definitions of it and not by the others. And that's a big challenge for all of us.
So, Nativa, if you look at the world around you and you look at where we're going sort of in the future, then what are the major technology trends and what do we need to do to take advantage of them?
Well, I think the clouds is now very popular. Everybody talks about it and being in the cloud. And I think a lot of us started to take advantage of it. A lot can be done in the cloud. In a way, it frees us from taking care of storing our own data and buying so much storage and relying on our own computer and security. Security is so expensive and in locality. So it's nice to defer security to somebody else and our data to somebody else and share it. I mean, that's a nice thing. The greatest thing with being in the cloud, cloud computing, is that you can share more easily with others what you do and do collaboration work. So I see the future is do not reinvent the wheel. You know, so many corporations are competing with each other instead of cooperating with each other. Imagine if, I know, maybe you need competition because competition drives the industry. But on the other hand, they keep on reinventing the wheels. Each company in the same, let's say, in the same industry, they're doing similar things. And why not share instead of just compete? So I think the cloud computing can afford that collaboration, and save a lot of, not just on your local computer, but on effort also, and the effort of security, which is so costly. So I think there is a future there if we know how to use it wisely. Of course, another thing is the storage capability. As you know, we can judge it almost by the cost, how you can have terabytes and, you know, costing, you know, very little, and we have more and more and more data. So on one hand, having a lot of data is good. On the other hand, it's kind of scary. I was just dreaming about it last night. It's almost like swimming in an ocean and not drowning. I think, in a way, I think we are all kind of survivors, floating on water from the big, our ship is maybe sinking, and we're swimming in an ocean of data. So on one hand, the data is, it's fabulous to have so much data at our hand because a lot can be converged and used. You can really go into all directions and gather things that you need and create clusters of data that you need for your, whatever you're doing. So, and on the other hand, you have the sinking factor. You may actually drown with all this data and lose yourself. So I think it's a balance that we need to be aware of and live in this world and try to do good and not the other way. Just imagine if you're floating in this water, in this sea of data, and let's say you have another survivor next to you. I mean, you can help each other float and reach the shore, or you can hang on the other person and sink with that person. So I think data, the storage capabilities, together with the cloud computer, can go hand in hand. I mean, we can work together and help each other, like be like the network weavers that we can all be using the networks and help each other and on the other hand, not hurt each other and not sink each other. So it can be a win-win and not a lose-lose situation. And we need the wisdom of some maybe future leaders to guide us doing that. And I hope they are there, those leaders, and hopefully they will lead us into that. And I hope to be there and help too, you know, one way or the other. You know, being a teacher takes so much of your time. And, I mean, of course, I hear of all the technology, new technologies are being created all around me. I know Israel, my native country, is so great in IT. I mean, I read about it every day. There's a new things invented, especially in medicine and, in cell biology, everywhere. And being a teacher, you cannot really get too involved in other things because you're there to help your students. So in a way, I'm looking for my retirement so I can maybe do other things and learn and maybe create and maybe contribute in other areas. But I think the world is exciting. There's so much there, and hopefully we will all learn to swim this world and not sink and not drown, and learn to navigate this big information, big cyberspace, and collaborate. I mean, I think collaboration is the world of the future, and so we can create new things that can save us all.
You know, what are your top recommended resources?
Well, I think I'm reading ACM, you know, the Association of Computer Machinery, which I like a lot. Other sources, I like CPSR, Computer Professional Social Responsibilities. We have an activist list. I read that. I tell you, there's so much social networks around and so much going on that we are bombarded with news. I read the New York Times every day, so that's something, a source of information for me. I listen to NPR. That's another great source. And I always tell my students, just listen to that instead of music when you drive to school. So those are my sources, basically. You know how on email we always share so much. I get bombarded from all my friends from all sides, and I send through. But I try to limit the sending and limit my reading, because you can get drowned.
Do you have any added stories that you want to share?
Well, I think I've already told you many anecdotes already. The blogging, for example. Now I have one of my daughters on a blog, and even though my daughters I have two of them living in Israel now, even though they were born here, and one living in New York who is a doctor. You know, if it were not for technology, I would not be able to reach them so easily. But now I'm reading my daughter's blog every day. And it's amazing. We don't have time to talk on the phone or even email. We email here and there, but it's nice that I can learn about her from her blog. So I'm thinking here, technology is really helping me get in touch with my family. The same way that when I first arrived to this country, my little brother was only 15, and I didn't, you know, in those days, telephones were so expensive. I forgot how much we were paying, $20 a minute. So, you know, since I had email, and well, he was not 15 anymore. I think he started working at the university, so he got email too, and we were communicating on email every day, and it was amazing that no one understood it. How can you talk to your brother every day from Israel to here? It's just because there was email. We were the first to use email on a daily basis. And that was in the early 80s, you know, or even end of the 70s. So now the social networks are the way for the young to communicate. I'm on it too. I'm on LinkedIn and on Facebook, but mostly because my students are there and because I get invited, and here and there my kids share some pictures with me. So it's kind of nice. I just cannot afford the time right now to do this. I don't, you know, but I know all the young just go there every day and just keep in touch with friends. So I don't know what will be. I mean, we are spread all over the world. My small family is spread all over the world. There were times where we were on five different continents or four different continents. Now we're only on two continents. So that's kind of nice that I can catch them all in one trip sometime. And I'm glad to have technology there that connects us besides the actual trip by plane.
So we're down to the last part of our interview here, just a couple of questions left. You know, you talked about this earlier, your father was an artist and quite a famous one as well, and you have this passion for art. You know, why is it important to you?
Well, I came into art pretty late, even though I grew up with it. I noticed that in times of stress or in time of in hard times in general, it serves me as therapy. I can get up totally absorbed in it. So it occupies my mind, and yet the creativity is such a wonderful thing. I think men and women were born to be creative. And this is my venue. I think everybody should find a way to express themselves. So some do this through speech, some through song, some through music. And I find, you know, through sculpture and painting that I can express myself easily. Also through writing, but didn't get much time to do a lot of writing. And it is beautiful just to pour your colors on papers or on canvas and see great shapes come out of it, you know. And I never plan in advance what I'm going to do. I let my hand go, and I guess my hand is connected to my body and brain and soul, and it just like it goes, and it's beautiful things can come, and I like to share them. For me, I do paint for myself, but when I find something beautiful, I like to share it with others. Because my house is so full already with my father's paintings, other people's paintings, and my own paintings. I now give them away. I know it's hard to sell, and I do sell here and there, but I just like to give them away to my friends. It's nice to see that other people like it. I do exhibit almost every year. I do a small exhibit sometimes at Northeastern University in the library. And even during my exhibits, I invite some of my African friends to exhibit with me, or some of my Israeli friends that are artists. And I'm having one coming up in June also. And I just had one in October. It's nice to share the world with my beauty, my inner beauty, which I put on walls. And hopefully it renders some other people happy.
You know, we've covered a lot of areas in this interview, but perhaps I missed some questions. So if you were doing this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answer?
Well, I would ask a person a question like, do you have any regrets? It's always a good question to ask, I think. And in a way, I wish I could say there's no regrets at all. And probably it is my answer. But if I dig down and said, well, what could I have done differently? You know, if I really wanted the success that other people usually look for, you know, like being more famous, publish more, things like of that sort, I probably would have applied to other universities. You know, I got my first job here at Northeastern University before I had my doctorate. And throughout my years here, I took a couple years leave and finished my doctorate. And at that time, I could have applied somewhere else, and I didn't. So, I mean, that's maybe a small regret. But on the other hand, I kept my family together, and that's an important thing. So I should say really no regret. But it's a good question anyhow. I think, Stephen, you should add it to your list of questions in the future. Other questions is, what advice to the young can you give? I think you asked something like that yourself. And I would say, as an answer to that, is to take time, at least once a week, to be with yourself. And we're so busy, you know, being connected with the rest of the world. We don't think about just shutting off the radio, shutting off music, shutting off everything, the telephone, TV, books. Actually, books maybe not, because people just do not do reading enough. I mean, that's another thing you should do, even reading. If that's the thing you want to do for yourself, that's great. But just be with yourself, either meditate, go for a walk, sit in your garden, work on gardening, whatever you like. Sit in a cafe, even on a cup of coffee. And I mean, you can listen to music, but not talk show. I mean, just sit with yourself and go inside and just rest in a way. Just rest and listen to your inner voice. So I think that's one thing that I would say to people. Also, I think it's a famous saying that once a year, travel to a place you have never been to. And I think new things should be, even if you cannot afford to go somewhere far. I'm sure that in your own neighborhood, there are lots of places you haven't been to. In the last 10 years, I discovered the Skokie Lagoons here near me, and it is like heaven. It's a beautiful place that I think a lot of people don't ever visit. It's lagoons, you know, surrounded by forests. And every time I go there, I'm almost alone. There's hardly anybody there, especially in winter, and it's so beautiful in winter. In the snow, dredging the snow, deep to your knees, it's beautiful. And even in summertime, you know, you can walk in the woods. It's just amazing, and I don't understand why not more people are there. But anywhere you live, I'm sure there is a corner there that you haven't been to yet, some forgotten river, some forgotten, you know, woods. Visit and just change a little your mind. And another thing I would say to the young, advice to the young, is to be a little bit crazy sometimes, you know, take risks. Take chances, do something crazy that maybe you're too embarrassed to do. But I think once in a while, once a year, let's say, do something totally crazy. Surprise your friends and family there. It may change your life. You don't know where this will take you. I think being crazy is good for you because it's not really crazy. It's probably your inner you coming out, and you don't know. It may change your life for the best.
Well, yeah, Tiva, you're taking us on this really remarkable journey of sharing your experiences, your insights, your wisdom, and, you know, it's just been a great privilege. So thank you for taking the time. I know you're very busy and, you know, sharing all of this with our audience, and it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Stephen, for being here with me and asking me all this. It has been a journey for me just talking to you, you know, looking back into my past and looking into the future. I think we should all do that, you know, and I wish you can be with each one of us here and interview all of us. I think it's really great. Thank you so much.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with distinguished scientist, educator, author, artist, leader, activist, Dr. Nyativa Kaptori, who shared her insights into computing, education, global condition, the future of technology, career, and her many life lessons.